Today is July 28th, 2008. My name is Garrett Blauvelt, and today I will be speaking with Claire Chafin. Mr. Chafin was a Navy corpsman and has been involved in a number of veterans organizations, such as the Marine Corps League, the Disabled American Veterans, the 4th Marine Division Association, the American Legion, and the Veterans of Foreign Wars. Just to start things off, Mr. Chafin, where and when were you born?
I was born in Jackson, Michigan, January 13th, 1926.
Okay, and where exactly is Jackson, Michigan?
Kalamazoo, Michigan is 50 miles west. Ann Arbor is 75 miles east.
Okay, so sort of smack in the middle of the state.
And 38 miles from Lansing, which is the capital of Michigan.
And you grew up in Jackson?
17 years of my life, I milked cows. And
so were your parents farmers or?
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we had a farm, a small farm.
Okay.
But my father was working with the CCC and the different government programs for building national parks and so forth.
Okay.
And he was a general contractor also.
So is that what had you, is that what got your interest in contracting later on in life? Or
yes.
That, okay.
Yes.
And how many children were in your family?
Six boys and two girls.
Okay.
My father wanted a baseball team. We got five boys and then the girls started messing up.
And what was life growing up? What was life like growing up in Jackson?
Well, it was fun. We did all the things. We were poor kids.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we lived 20 foot from the New York Central Railroad, right away of the New York Central Railroad. And when the other kids had roller skates or ice skates, we took pet milk cans and put on our shoes and took a stone and mashed them in, so, and we thought we were just as rich as they were, but we were poor, and we had patch pants and so forth. My mother, God bless her soul, she must have been working day and night to just keep us going, and I think the young people today are being cheated because they don't get outside and do things with nature and so forth. And they sit in front of a TV and God help them if the power goes off at the supermarket or something, because nobody can get out because they don't know how to use their minds to add up what the groceries are, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What were the type of responsibilities in your household? This was a small farm, so what types of things would you be doing as chores during the course or growing up? What types of things did you have to do to help out?
Well, I milked cows before I went to school in the morning, so that got you up around 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
And I milked four cows, and we had a garden. We grew everything to eat and so forth. And being that we were in the Depression, my father was a general contractor, as I told you, and he had to go in and the family baked bread and so forth, and I delivered around with a wagon, and my brothers we all had assigned jobs, usually using a hoe, weeding out the garden and so forth, a big job, yeah, and milking the cows and so forth. So.
What were some of your childhood interests growing up? Did you play any sports or were you involved in it?
I played soccer in school and football, and we had my dad build a baseball diamond. As I said, he won the baseball team. And so all the neighbors would come to our house, and that's the way my parents wanted it. where we weren't running around getting into trouble and so forth. They kept the activity at our house. And so, and when we'd play football, we'd go over to the factory where they had nice green grass, but the cows were out there. That was a pasture also. And
okay.
Sometimes you would slip into a cow pasture or something. It was disconcerting, to mm-hmm. say the least, yeah.
So you had to avoid something other than a player on the other team.
Indeed. Indeed.
Yeah. What kind of impact was the Depression like for your family? Your father later worked for the CCC.
He was working in administrative end. Of
okay.
It, yeah. And, but my uncle, several of my uncles, worked in the CCCs, and that's where the national parks have these block or stone walls and so mm-hmm. forth, and all the campsites and so forth. They would work on those, and then my father got back into construction, and we built airports and had trucks to carry asphalt on the road. My dad would buy a woods, and I was the one that went up and topped off the top of trees.
Okay.
And you swing mm-hmm. 6 or 8 feet back and forth when it fell off. And then we'd chop it up for wood, and we'd deliver it around town and so forth. And I had my first driver's license when I was 13 years old.
Okay.
So that being a farm kid, you could get it. In Michigan at that time. So we would look like a convoy going. Each one of us boys would have a truck filled with wood, cordwood, to sell in town. Mm-hmm. We did anything to make ends meet.
Okay.
And I don't ever remember, you know, the kids these days ask for their allowance and so forth. We never asked for it. And we don't ever remember getting it. I don't. And but we had spending money, you know. But everything went back into the family at that time. And, so I remember one time we were in the woods, and I had a flat tire on the front tire, and my brother had already left. And these were dump trucks, so not having a jack or a pump or anything, and I just piled a little more wood, dropped the tailgate down, piled more wood on the back end of it so the front end came up, and brought it back into town. Now, nobody told me how to do this, but that's what I'm getting at. Kids used their heads and common sense back then. And not that the kids don't do it today, but they're more intent on video games and so forth. And as I say, I think they're cheated in some of the wonderful experience we had growing up.
Did you go camping or anything like that?
Oh, every year. Okay. Every year. My dad would take off, and we would pitch a tent actually, whole families, uncles, aunts, everything came, and my dad got a big tent from someplace. I don't know exactly where he got it. It's almost like a circus tent. Okay. Where everybody could eat, and we'd go out, and my uncle had a speedboat, and he made a hydroplane out of plywood, or some kind of wood, and we would ride around all over the lake.
So where would you go camping? Like, where would this have been?
What lake? Clark's Lake, Pleasant
okay.
Lake,
okay.
Any of the lakes around. You know, Michigan has chains of mm-hmm. many, many lakes, so there was always a place to go camping. So.
going back towards schooling, where did you go to school at the local high school in Jackson?
Yes, I went to grade school at Bloomfield School.
Okay.
And it's surprising what I learned in the fifth grade. Some of the kids growing up right now can't have no recollection of anything that I learned, like the states and the capitals. We had to learn every one of them in the fifth grade. And the young people today, again, are being cheated. I don't know what they're teaching in schools, but they're certainly not teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic and common sense. So,
And you would have been and then you went to high school there. What were your favorite subjects going to school?
mathematics
Okay.
was mine. I liked mathematics and history. I loved history, the Renaissance and the printing press, Columbus coming to America, or ended up in South America, but not here in America. And Leif Erikson that came across on the land chain, and kids don't even know that one time there was a place where you could walk to the United States. So,
Did you want to be a contractor when you were growing up, or is that something that
no,
came?
actually, I wanted to be as far away from contracting as possible. So I went into the service as a corpsman because I wanted to be a doctor. That's what I really wanted to be, so that I could help people.
So you joined to be a corpsman.
I joined to be a
Okay.
corpsman.
And then the other question is, why did you select to be a Navy corpsman as opposed to other? What was there a decision process there, or why did you pick that specific branch of?
As I say, I wanted to be a doctor,
Okay.
and my two brothers that went in ahead of me, had they waited 6 months until I was able to join, we all may have been submariners, on submarines. I may have not even thought of being a doctor, but and the two events never made a difference to me particularly. I still wanted to be a doctor.
Okay. Well, sort of going to the beginning of World War II, do you remember where you were when Pearl Harbor was attacked? Do you remember what you were doing then?
Yes, we were. I think that was on a Sunday morning, and we were all getting up, we were going on a camping trip. And when the news come in that Pearl Harbor had been hit, it was hard to believe that anyone would attack our country. Or, well, it was not, it was a possession, but not a state at that time. And we sat down and talked between my two brothers, Elmer and Kenneth, and we said, we need to get in and help. We're not going to let people run over us.
So this decision was made the same day, pretty much,
This
or?
was made the same day.
Okay.
However, none of us went in at that time, but we agreed that we would wait until I was old enough, and it got where the war heated up more so, and my two brothers went in 6 months before. They wouldn't wait for me to become
So they went in the
17.
summer of 1942, they joined.
They went in 42, and
Okay. And then you joined in February of 1943,
yeah, correct.
and you were sent to Great Lakes for boot camp.
Yes.
Is that where you were put into the service, or did you, how did you join the service? Did you sign up locally and then get sent to Great Lakes, or how was that done?
Well, actually, it was at the post office in Jackson, Michigan, mm-hmm. where we signed up. And actually, the church had a program, and it was called Medical Cadet Corps. I don't know whether they were thinking that someday we'd be in a war or something, but the church had this. And so when we all signed up, and I was the only one that had any experience with any organization, you know, Boy Scouts or anything else, mm-hmm. you know. They made me the leader who carried all the records to Detroit. Mm-hmm. And then from Detroit, we took a train to Great Lakes. And going through Great Lakes in February, and they had no boilers in. And mm-hmm. The chief petty officer insisted you take a shower every morning. And he would check, see if you were wet. He just couldn't sprinkle a little water on you and say you had a shower.
Check for ice, maybe.
right. And then we had nothing on our face, but he made us shave, too. Mm-hmm. And we had nothing but peach fuzz or something.
Were most of the people coming in with you, were they about your age?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they were all about the same age.
And were you training in boot camp with people who also wanted to be corpsmen, or were you training with just people going into the Navy?
Just going into the Navy, okay. Yeah. And we did our boot camp, and then...
What was a typical day like in Navy boot camp around then?
Well, we had wooden guns that we carried, and mainly it was marching, and they made me a third-class petty officer in boot camp. Mm-hmm. That don't mean that it was a permanent position. Okay. But we would do... close order drill, and learn to take orders mostly, and it certainly was an easier boot camp than later when I went through the Marine boot camp. So, we got through with that, and then I went over to the main side to take corps school, mm-hmm. hospital corps school. And actually I went a little ahead of myself because I was a fairly decent singer, and they put me into the Great Lakes Naval Choir, which was broadcast to all the troops okay. around the country. And they gave you a like a harp mm-hmm. that you put on your sleeve.
Did
like
that grant you any special privileges, or was that?
No.
Okay.
Still cost you the same amount for a cup of coffee. Yeah. But I have a diploma for that somewhere. So here, my wife, there's a lot of things that she had that I haven't gotten up with yet. But the corps school was, they had us working many hours. You know, I mean, we hardly slept because the war needed corpsmen mm-hmm. badly, or anyone that could do give shots and so forth. And we had no idea that we would do some of the things that we had were trained, and I used to go watch the operations. Any operation, I could watch it. And
so that wasn't something that was required. That was you taking the extra step to make sure that you learned as much as you could. Okay.
Right. And there were other ones that were in the amphitheater like, and when they made an incision and the tissue would fall back and the little blood vessels would start to flow, they'd pass out, and it didn't bother me. I could handle it, and the doctors were amazed that I could stand up there, and sometimes I was the only one, but I wanted, and that was part of our training to go watch those operations. So.
What types of things would they have taught you in this in your initial training? What types of medical procedures would they teach?
Well, how to take blood pressure, temperatures, pulse, respiration, how to give shots. In fact, each one of us were a guinea pig for somebody else to give shots, and it was normal saline solution or distilled water. And but we had a red book about 2 inches thick, and like a regular reading book that you'd have. But it had all types of medical procedures, how to do appendectomy or appendicitis, tracheotomies, most anything that you would come up against.
Was this something they gave you, or was this something that you would
It
use
was
for
issued.
class? Did you go over this, or was it just like a reference book?
It was a reference book, but we were working out of this
Okay.
book all through the training, through the 7 weeks that we put in there.
And did you get a sense of what was expected in combat from what you were supposed to do there? Like, what, did you have a sense that you were supposed to provide basic treatment and they have good lines of or good medical lines to get people out? Was there, what did they into, or did you get any sense on what you would be doing or what the procedure would be later on?
No, we had no idea
Okay.
what we would face in combat. In fact, on the first invasion that we went in on Roy and Namur, everybody, we had no fear halfway in. The other half, everybody was afraid. And anyone that says they're not, I don't want them too close to me because they're going to do something dangerous. So, but the overall picture, you're looking at the man on your right and the man on your left, and he's just as frightened as you are, but you don't want to let him down. There's no way that you're going to fall apart so that they will fall apart. So you are trying to hold everything together for you. He's probably doing the same thing over there on the man on his right and left. But when you come to the realization of what the war is really about, I have one little thing about the first man I treated on in the Marshall Islands was a fellow with 13 bullet holes in him. I treated them all, and as I was walking away from him, I had given him a shot of morphine, and as I was walking away from him, he seemed to be unconscious, and I said, "This poor devil will never make it." And I thought I had said it to myself. When I came back over to the Oakland Naval Hospital a couple of years afterwards, I was walking through the ward, and a fella hollered, "Hey, Doc, come over here." And I walked over, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "No, I don't remember you." He said, well, I'm the one that you said this poor devil will never make it. He said, you made me so mad that I was determined to make it back. He said, I had no idea I'd ever see you again, but I'm glad I did.
So the, your training at Great Lakes, it couldn't prepare you for, well, there's nothing that could prepare you for what's actually going to happen. But in terms of the medical knowledge that you had, you felt that you had a pretty good knowledge of medical procedures at the time?
Is that... We thought so, but we found out we had so much more to learn after we actually got into the combat situation. You're never prepared for anything that you would see. But you had a job to do, and you did it.
Yeah. After Great Lakes was completed, what did you do next?
Actually, we got on a troop train, and we headed for, we didn't know where, because they didn't tell us.
Okay.
And as we were going on the train, the night came. Well, actually, all the curtains were pulled because they didn't want the public to know that that was a troop train. And so it was dark inside there after nightfall. The one of the fellows said, hey, Chafin, how about turning that light bulb off up there? And me, like a dummy, I reached up to twist the bulb because we couldn't find a switch on the wall anywhere. And here I burnt the thunder out of myself because it was a gas lamp.
Oh.
That is how old that car was, the train was that we were riding on. They had gas lamps for lights in that. But we went on, and actually we stopped in Albuquerque, I think, or somewhere in Texas. And they actually had the Harvey girls. You ever heard of the Harvey girls?
I've heard the name before.
Yeah, well, they're hostesses or waitresses, if you will. But they lived right on the, in the railroad station, you know, they had quarters for them and so. But that was the only time I ever saw them. I guess they went out after our first trip out there. But we stopped and ate, and they brought food out to us. Okay. They wouldn't let us off the train. They didn't know if they'd get us back.
How long is this taking to get there? Do you remember how long the trip would have been?
Seemed like forever. I think it took several days, but everybody was joking. There was always somebody that had a full storehouse of jokes, and they could repeat them 24 hours a day. You'd get tired of listening, and they'd never repeat themselves. How they could retain all that is beyond me, but it was an interesting trip.
Okay.
And then I went to North Island, and that was an air base, and the first one that I had to take care of there was actually a fellow that walked into a prop on the, you know, propeller driven plane.
So you were taking care of people injured at the base?
At the base, okay. Yeah. And several of them had to walk away. I took care of what was there, and then they thought that I would make a good Marine corpsman, I guess, so they sent me to the Marines.
Okay.
And I went to Camp Elliott, and they gave us the same training that the the...
So you had to go through boot camp again, just a different type of boot camp.
Well, there you learn when they said hit the deck, you didn't stand up and look around to see who was there. You dropped down and they hit the deck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference between a lot of training. Other ones, they don't instant obedience. They don't do it. And I think that's what's losing a lot of men from the other branches of the service, because Marines just respond immediately when a command is given. Mm-hmm. You don't question or look around, you drop. So that's...
Was there anything to identify yourself that you were going to be a corpsman? Did anyone know that that's where you were going, or were you just in the general population of Marines and just looked like everyone else?
Oh, no, you wore a Red Cross on your sleeve. Yeah. Uniforms, the different ones, summer and winter uniform. However, we started out... with a big 3-inch band, white, that you put on your sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
With a Red Cross on. Well, when we hit the beach, that's the first thing that came off and stomped it in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Japanese would use it as a target, and they'd just go about 5 inches over from the white, the Red Cross on the arm, and hit a heart shot. So we were losing corpsmen right and left. So we got rid of those.
And that would probably be something, if you think of like the casualty, even now with regards to taking care of another person. If you don't have a corpsman, it's going to be a lot more difficult to deal with.
Well, they figured they would, when a corpsman went down, they would lose at least 20 Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Because of his not being able to take care of the wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in reality, it was a lot more, because I don't ever remember digging a foxhole. Because
mm-hmm.
the minute we hit the beach, somebody would holler, "Corpsman, corpsman." You'd take care of that one, somebody else would holler, "Corpsman." In fact, we had the entrenching tool or the shovel and on our backs, and I just threw mine away, because you jump in a hole with somebody else. Mm-hmm. that needs mm-hmm. your attention. So
did that start through basic training? Was there already that relationship where people understood how important the corpsman was going to be, or did that happen later on?
No, they used to call us a lot of uncomplimentary names. Which I better not put on that machine. I'll tell you afterwards. But they actually, the Navy really looked down on the corpsman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
However, the Marines held you in high esteem.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you a name that they had for dental assistants, corpsmen that become dental assistants. They'd call them dental dillies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't too complimentary.
No.
but the other names were a lot worse than that.
Okay.
So much for that. Yeah.
So through training, were you trained on the equipment that the Marines used? Were you trained on the weapons that were used by the Marines?
Yes, we were.
Okay.
We had to go on the firing line, and
mm-hmm.
Being a farm kid, I never got Maggie's drawers. That's the red flag that went up when you missed the target altogether. But that's what they called it. I was pretty good. In fact, with a .45, I shot with the a major and a colonel in competition, because
mm-hmm.
I was so good with a weapon. And so no, we had to take, and the same with hand-to-hand combat.
Mm-hmm.
I have a black belt in jiu-jitsu and karate.
Okay.
And I had a Japanese instructor, and as I told you, my two brothers went down on submarines, Japanese. So when they asked for a volunteer to show a new hold on, I put my hand up, and it was the hold that you take their wrist, twist it, and roll them over your mm-hmm. shoulder, and you throw them about 10 feet.
Okay.
And however, I didn't throw him. I grabbed his hand, and when my hands hit the deck, my knees were right down there too, and he laid on his back just gasping for air because mm-hmm. I knocked the wind out of him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, anytime they wanted a volunteer, he never asked for a volunteer after that. I was his, he called automatically for me to show a new hold on. I was the one that got thrown and so forth. But I passed first in that class because I wanted to learn, and he resented a little bit, but he had tears in his eyes when I left because, you know, but he wanted me to stay and transfer out of the, with being a corpsman and become a full Marine with sergeant stripes, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I had things I had to do.
Did you have to treat anyone during boot camp? Was that something where people would know that you were a corpsman? So if they had any type of injury, they might ask you for assistance?
Or? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we, the corpsman, as I told you, there's 290 men in the company. And the corpsman was always the last man, so that if anyone fell out of ranks, that you could take care of them, you know, blisters or whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, they used to let them have a 10-minute break. It was either 5 minutes or 10. I think it was 10. When you're on a 26-mile hike or something. And so when the column stopped and we were carrying a knapsack and a haversack.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it weighed about 65, 75 pounds, something like that.
Okay.
And a rifle. And of course, corpsmen carried two extra bags because with medical gear, tincture benzoin for blisters and to toughen the skin up and so on. And so the column stops and you walk to the side and you go to take off your gear, and about the time you got it halfway off, somebody at the head of the column hollers, "Corpsman!" So you run to the head of the column and take care of his blisters and so forth, and then you're ready to take your gear off again and wait for the column to pass so you can take your point at the end again. Well, I don't know whether they did it for pure meanness or what, but the guy that was sitting right next to me hollered "Corpsman," you know, when the column stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So here I have to run way back to the back of the column and treat him. Of course, he had blisters, so it wasn't that they were trying to play games mm-hmm. with me, but I often thought they were. So
it was a 10-minute break for just about everyone.
Everybody got it.
Except the corpsman.
But the corpsman didn't get it. Right. Yeah.
And after you do boot camp with the Marines, where are you assigned next?
Well, we got on a ship and we went directly into combat on Roy and Namur in the Marshall Islands.
And would you have gone into combat with the same people you were treating? The same group of Marines from boot camp?
Yes.
So they kept everyone together?
Oh, no, I take it back.
Okay.
In boot camp, I went through in Camp Elliott.
Mm-hmm.
Then they sent me to Camp Pendleton about 2 weeks before we shoved off. In fact, they took pictures of everybody for the the Red Book, you know, and I didn't get my picture in it because the pictures had already been taken before I got there. So, but I guarantee you I was there. So from there, we went into the combat zone. And
did you have any sense when you boarded the boat that that was going to happen almost immediately once you got there? Did you have any knowledge of what was going to happen next?
Or? No, we thought we were going to Hawaii.
Okay.
And it wasn't a boat. It was a ship.
Mm-hmm.
Boats or rowboats,
okay,
or something. Not to correct you, but...
it's fine.
Constructive criticism.
Okay. What was the ship like? What type of ship was it? Was it a converted ship or was it a...
It was a Liberty ship.
Okay.
With... five tiers of bunks,
mm-hmm,
and my position was the top bunk,
mm-hmm,
for one night. And after that, I slept out on the deck in the the lifeboats, which were like cork all the way around and one by a quarter inch slats that they put in gardens and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the bottom was like, where water could come in and out. But the sides were about 12 inches high,
mm-hmm,
maybe 18 inches. And it was all cork so that you would float. And they were stacked five or six high also on the deck. I just got claustrophobia. I had to get out.
So you got sick on the ship. I know that's a common thing, is people not feeling well on their...
No, I didn't get sick.
Okay.
I just felt...
Didn't want to be...
I was confined down there. When you're this high from hitting the ceiling of, mm-hmm, the, you know, where the pipes and so forth are, I just didn't like to be...
Okay.
When I got back, I didn't like going on elevators for the same reason, because when the door shut, I was frantic. You know, I had to get out and so. But we went right into combat, and we had two-ounce bottles of brandy that we would give the sentries to keep them alert at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so on Roy there... they had sand dunes there, and I took 12 bottles and walked over, and the guard, the sentry, hollered for halt who goes there. You had to give a sign and a countersign, mm-hmm, and we went through that routine, and I raised my head up, and ding! A bullet went by me.
Mm-hmm.
It was a sentry shot at me.
Oh.
So I sat right down behind that sand dune, and I drank all those 12 bottles of brandy that we had. So that we took care of the wounded, whatever. We removed shrapnel and sutured up,
I know I've read that a lot of medical advancements happen through wartime and just trying to finding better ways to do things.
Right.
Did you notice that when you first arrived, your first combat experience, did you start noticing that they had trained you one thing, but you were finding ways to do things a little differently, or were...
Oh, yes. There was things that they never taught us in school that... we did know how to put sulfanilamide. Everything was sulfa drugs back then. Mm-hmm. And after Roy and Moore, and we came back, then penicillin came out, and mm-hmm, we started using penicillin. You're never prepared for what you're going to have to do. And they would be, sometimes people would lose a finger or anything, and you never could find the part, you know, because they would run towards you or sit down so they'd lose a finger or something, and you'd have to stop the bleeding and put sulfanilamide on and wrap it and evacuate them immediately, you know, or get them evacuated.
What was the procedure like for evacuating someone?
You had to tell what treatment you give. If you give morphine, you had to tell that you gave one ampule of morphine for pain. What type of a bandage you did. You had a little card that you hooked it on their buttons on their jacket, their dungarees, what we went in on. And give a short summary of what you did so that they wouldn't repeat it. They could go on to a more advanced. And then you would either leave them there for the band, or the cooks would be litter bearers, you know. I mean, they would take the wounded to the aid station on the beach, and then a doctor would see them there and then evacuate them to either one of us.
So the procedure would be, you would make the initial examination and decide, and then there'd be a doctor, and you'd send them back to the beach. A doctor on the beach would check, and then he would decide if they're an immediate case to go to the ship or if they're not as immediate. Would it be just something similar to that, or is that?
Well, you would treat them.
Okay.
You physically treated them to the best of your ability, like the fellow that lost his finger. You put a compressed bandage to keep it from bleeding, because he could bleed to death before he got to the beach, you know. So then the doctor would take off the bandage and see whether he needed to do something else before putting him on a LCVM or LCVP and send him back to the ship or an alligator tank or whatever, you know.
Okay.
So it was a process of a corpsman, then a doctor would check it. After the corpsman would treat it, and the doctor would check it, and if further treatment, then he would take care of that and see that he was evacuated to the hospital ship.
Okay. So, and just out of curiosity, what would be the time frame of this occurring? Like, how soon could a person be on a ship, or how soon could they expect to be transported to a ship? Would that be a matter of a couple of hours, or?
Depending on how far you were in on the invasion.
Okay.
Usually, when you're taking care of somebody right on the beach, there's always a piece of equipment coming in, taking troops in. So the doctors would just take over and say, you take these litters, I got 8 or 10, I want you to take them back, and those that were ambulatory or could stand, then they would stand, and so it was fairly quick when we were on the beach. But when you get further inland, like on Saipan, it took maybe a half hour, 45 minutes to get down to the beach.
Okay.
Because of mortar fire or something that was holding you up. And then the whole process may take a couple hours or so before they actually would get on the ship per se, yeah.
And how long would you be doing? I imagine earlier on in the invasion you'd be working longer, but what could you anticipate? Like, how long would you be going before you could take a break of any kind?
I don't recall taking breaks. I really don't, because as I said, the minute somebody hollered corpsman, you never thought twice. You just moved to where the sound was. And the Japanese got pretty good at that because they would holler corpsmen also. And then we lost a few corpsmen because of the Japanese, because some of them, well, we had one captain, Japanese captain, that was born in San Francisco, went through UCLA, went back to Japan and become an officer, and we captured him. And I was with the group that captured him, and he could speak better English than I can.
Okay.
And there's a lot said about interning the Japanese, you know, in mm-hmm. California. However, after we saw firsthand that a person that was born in the United States went through our colleges and school and then went back and fought us, you didn't know what their sympathies were, so you couldn't blame the people for interning them at that time for the safety of a lot of people.
Okay. So, I guess with regards to this, so you would have been on the first, your first location, you would have been treating primarily wounded. Was there any other kinds of treatments that you had to do? Would there have been any kinds of illness, any kind of like trench foot type injuries that would come up?
Well, we had, you always dealt with dysentery.
Okay.
And we would treat that also. And but the first invasion, it was a breaking in process.
Mm-hmm.
You were busy. You didn't have a spare minute. And it didn't seem like we had much time to sleep. In fact, we were a little bit afraid to go to sleep because the Japanese would come up to a foxhole, if you happened to be in one, and would bayonet. They wouldn't shoot their rifle because they didn't want to be, but they would bayonet Marines and so forth in their foxholes. And I found many of them that had been bayoneted, and they thought it was a friend coming up, and in turn, it was a Japanese. But our real battles, the real tough ones came on Saipan and Tinian, and there we. To go further into some of the medical treatment, I was in a foxhole. A fella was having trouble breathing,
mm-hmm.
so I jumped in the foxhole with him, and the foxhole wasn't probably twice as big as that cocktail table there.
Okay.
And I had to do a tracheotomy on him because he couldn't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
His face was, he was wounded badly in the face. And as I was starting the operation, a Japanese Zero came in and machine gunned either side of the foxhole we were in.
Mm-hmm.
Had he been a foot one way or the other, I wouldn't be talking to you. But I did, in a tracheotomy, you don't stop when you start.
Here.
And for, I've been asked sometimes, where did you get the tube to put into their throat?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it was the tourniquet that we had was made of rubber, and they were hollow on the inside. And I use that, and that again goes back to the common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody told me to ever use it besides cutting off the blood flow so you can take a blood pressure, you know. So, or give a shot in the venous.
Was doing a tracheotomy, was that something that you would have discussed at all during training? Or you said it was in the book, though, correct?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So you might have flipped by and seen what you had to do.
Well, when you're 5 or 6 days on a ship going mm-hmm. into combat, you have plenty of time to read or whatever. And I wanted all the knowledge that I could. Not only for myself, but to help whoever I, because you never knew what you were going to come into. And it was quite exciting to read the different things in this book that you may encounter, you know. So I also delivered 3 babies there on the island and amputated an arm. The doctor, this fella had slivers. They used wooden bullets. The Japanese used wooden bullets. And both hands had slivers, wood slivers in their hand. And so we had to remove both his arms. The doctor did one, said, "Watch what I'm doing, and you do the same thing." And so...
Was this because the doctor was too taxed? He was doing so much?
He was so busy, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it wasn't that he was lazy.
No.
Definitely wasn't that. But...
And would delivering babies, would that have been something that you would have at least, was that in the book that you were looking over?
Or no, that was never in the book. But being from a big family, yeah. We sometimes would peek in to see what was going on, you know,
okay.
And we saw the process. So we probably shouldn't have, but for them, it might have been a good idea because one was a breech birth.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to turn the baby around, and they were the natives that were on the island, you know, and so.
Was it common to treat natives on any of these islands, or would that have been
actually
unusual?
You treated anyone who needed attention. I even I treated the Japanese. We come on a Japanese that was in the ditch beside the road and was groaning and so forth. My driver wanted to shoot him, and I said, "No, I'm not here to." Now, if they're shooting at me, now mind you, I shot back
mm-hmm.
because I figured I needed to do something for my brother. So, but I'm not going to take advantage of somebody who is already hurt and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So, we took him into the stockade where all prisoners went, whether they were civilians or not. And it was late in the evening, so we had to stay because he couldn't go after dark usually. And you could be shot by our own friendly fire if you were out too early or too late. And so during the night, there was an attack from inside the stockade. They were throwing grenades at us. And how they got the grenades in, the babies, they would stuff grenades in the babies' diapers. And after that, everybody stripped. Man, woman, and child. It didn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
That they killed quite a few of our fellows before we realized that they had carried, you know, gotten some kind of weapons inside there. So,
I know you mentioned briefly that you had fired back. Was that for the Marine Corps, or being a Navy corpsman working with the Marine Corps? Were you issued a weapon? Did you carry anything in the field?
No, I was issued a carbine.
Okay.
However, I could have refused it. Being corpsmen were non-combatant. And you could declare yourself as a non-combatant.
So could they have had conscientious objectors?
Objectors,
okay.
Yeah. But I wanted the weapon. In fact, the first officer that I evacuated. They're supposed to turn the weapons off over to you when they get on your Jeep. And I refused to let them do that. I said, whenever we're in combat, you use your weapon. I don't care where you're shooting, but as long as you're on this Jeep, I said, they're not respecting our Red Cross. And so when we go out, y'all fire. And but when we got to the aid station, the officer unhooked his 45 and gave it to me. He said, you probably need this more than I will.
So you would have.
I had a 45 and a carbine.
Okay.
30-30 carbine. So, that's.
This is through. We're discussing Saipan right now. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Just to get I'm not familiar with dates here, but what would be the process of pulling the Marines out with regards to Corman? What would your responsibilities be? Were you left behind to make sure everyone was treated and leave, or did you leave?
No. When our outfit left, we left with it. We went directly from Saipan to Tinian.
Mm-hmm.
And Tinian is where the Enola Gay took off.
Okay.
To drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the Enola Gay actually got stuck. The bomb, you know, was so big that it had to be brought over on a destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to dig a hole, put the bomb in the hole, and drive the Enola Gay over to lift it up into the bomb bays. That's how big that was. And the front wheel got stuck, and they had to put matting down that they made temporary airfields with and so forth, and rolled the Enola Gay back off from it to take off with the bomb on. I wasn't there when it happened, but I was told that would happen. So then from there, we went back to Maui. And after Roy and the Moore, we went back to Maui. And then after Saipan, we went back to Maui.
Was this a break? Was this a break where you had some free time, or was this?
This is where you worked for the next invasion.
Okay.
Because
they would do training and exercises for it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you were training at all times. Now, when we got back there, they let everybody go on leave on liberty, you know, for a couple hours or 4 hours, I guess we had. However, there was two of us that stayed on duty and to take care of the sick bay. Well, there came a battalion order out that we had to be shot for bubonic plague. And we gave this one fella and myself, and it isn't the ones that already have serum in now like they do now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the needle's on and everything's ready to go. You just unwrap it and shoot a person. but he had to take a bottle, put the medication in it, and then put the needle on it and so forth and hand it to me. We gave 1,300 shots that day.
Wow.
And one particular instance where this 6'4" Marine, and we always told him, don't rub your arm after you've been shot, you know, just when you get the hypodermic needle, don't. He walked about, maybe 5 or 6 feet. And I said, hey, Marine, come back here. And he said, yeah, what is it? And I reached up and grabbed the needle out of his arm, pulled it out.
Ooh.
And he passed out. it was all right as long as he was walking away. But when I pulled the needle out, That was it for him.
With regards to who you were working with, was it pretty much the same people for any period of time, or would you have been shifting over?
No, we had 34 corpsmen and 3 doctors
okay.
that we went with. However, when we got to the different islands, I don't know just what the procedure is. How I even got hooked up with, some of it seemed like a big dream, you know. But Mitch McCracken was my ambulance driver, which was only a Jeep with a canvas top on it with a red cross on the top. And how I got with him, I don't know. To this day, I don't really know how we got connected, but we did go in front of our own front lines and brought out some wounded. There was 2 of us volunteered to go up with our Jeeps, and the first one, we had 13 people there to take out, and the other corpsman went by the book. It said you'll take 2 litter patients and 1 ambulatory, and that was it, and which meant that he would sit in the seat next to the corpsman. And I said, we've got too many men here, you need to take some more, put them on the front of the Jeep or anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I said, take your canvas off and put a couple of litters up there. He said, no, I'm going, I'm leaving, and he left. Well, I took my canvas off and put the 2 litters up there and 2 litters below where they normally go. And then the rest of them hung on wherever they could hang on. And halfway down the mountain, this was on Saipan also,
mm-hmm.
halfway down the mountain, we found the other Jeep, and it's a good thing he didn't take anybody else, because there's nobody left on it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So something was working with us to get most of them out. So we got, everybody went out.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't leave anybody behind. I would have stayed behind to get them all out. But
did you earn a certain amount of respect from the rest of the Marines who saw you just by your actions, that type of thing? Did they come back and did people come up to you afterwards, or is there a period, I guess, in your service as a corpsman where they see that and they say, this is how important this person is to us, they're willing to do?
Yeah.
And is there sort of, are you close enough to men where they can sort of, is there any hierarchy of, this corpsman's done this and this corpsman, or would that have ever happened? Or?
Well, General Peter Pace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said in his speech after I introduced him, he said, there is no higher form of endearment that one Marine can say to another to call a corpsman doc.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that came from the 4-star general. So,
okay.
And everybody, all the Marines have a great deal of respect for the corpsman.
Okay.
You know,
Do you remember at what point in your experience that you started being referred to as doc? Or is that?
The first.
Okay.
On Roy and the Moor, the first time we hit the beach, we were doc from then on. No more of these uncomplimentary names. Never heard another time. So.
So I guess after Tinian, you went back to Maui, is that correct?
Right, and regrouped for Iwo Jima.
And did you know that you were going to Iwo Jima? Did they
no?
Did they prepare you in any way for what Iwo Jima would be? Did when they did these training, did they try to anticipate what the conditions would be like where you were going? Did they differ in any way, or did they just practice?
Yeah,
landing.
You climbed pretty steep inclines and embankments and so forth. Now Mount Suribachi was 550 feet high,
mm-hmm.
but it was steep. But we would call that a hill, but it was a mountain over there, and it. I wasn't on that end of the island, so I never had the experience of going up it. But it was tough fighting getting up there. So, but there, when that beach had, there were so many wounded that I had to take the amphibious tractor that came in, and I had to pull my .45 out because he wasn't going to take any wounded back with him. And
was this just an individual who was
the operator? No, he was the operator of the amphibious tractor, and but he just wanted to get it back off in the beach. And so I pulled my .45 and said, "You will load these wounded on him." He jumped over the side and immediately handing up wounded so that because there's no drop end on the tanks that we went in on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It all, you had to load from the side. And so little steps going up the side of the.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the ambulance for that particular job. So, and you couldn't dig in on the island. However, it was a volcanic, the whole island was volcanic, so it... some of the fellows said that they at night it get cold, and you just dig a little deeper in the hole, and the heat from the volcano, the volcanic area, would warm one side of you anyway.
Okay, so you'd have to turn over at some point. Yeah.
Well, you couldn't dig in very well, you know. I mean, as you could see from that bottle that I showed you, you take one shovel out and two would come back in, you know. So, and as I say, I can't tell you that I ever dug a foxhole because I don't remember digging a foxhole, and because somebody holler corpsman, you know.
Do you know if the transportation or if the evacuation, did that improve how it was done over the course of your service? Did you notice any change in that, or was it pretty much the same where it would be get the person, you would find a way to get a person to the beach, doctor would check them, get them on the boat?
No, on the contrary. There were so many wounded that you would treat them, tag them, and depend on somebody else picking them up.
So someone else would be in charge of making sure that they got out. You would just go and treat. And
well, that was usually left up to the cooks and bakers and the ones that played instruments. You know, the band people of the band. And anyone that you just press anybody into service as a litter bearer, it didn't matter. as I say, but most of mine was treating and moving forward.
Okay.
And because you never got through treating before you were on somebody else treating.
Yeah.
And they could be within 2 foot. You take care of over here, and you just turn around and right there. So that's okay. Basically.
And then after Iwo Jima and the experience there, what were you doing after that? What would your next position have been?
Well, my mother, as I told you, my two mm-hmm. brothers were killed. And you've heard of the Sullivan Act.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother had me snatched out of the service under the Sullivan Act. And I was very upset that it took me a long time to get over that. I had so many more that I needed to treat that.
So was this during Iwo Jima that you were taken off, or was this after that was over?
No, during Iwo Jima.
Okay.
And I never heard of anybody else ever being taken off in the middle of a war, but I was, and that I had a lot of resentment because of it.
Did you have any sense that your mom had been trying that, or was that something that just came out of nowhere?
No, I had no idea that she was working on it, but she was a Gold Star mother twice and talking to different people, and they apparently said, well, you can get your third surviving son back if you do certain things, and apparently she did it, and was quite disturbing to me.
Okay. And then did you come immediately, were you let out of the service? Did you come home and were let out of the service? How did that go?
Well, I came back and, you see, when I went with the Marines, they detached you from the Navy mm-hmm. and attached you to the Marines. So I had to be detached from the Marines and attached back to the Navy because you had to go out with the same service mm-hmm. you came in with. And I went to Ford's River Rouge plant near Detroit mm-hmm. there. And they had a naval base there. And I became an instrument nurse. I set up the sterile fields and so forth. Now, they had nurses there. Mm-hmm. By that time, you know, when we first went in and so forth, they didn't have women in the service except nurses.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors would ask for me to be in the operating room over the nurse. What reason, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But this one doctor, he was a full commander, and I set up a sterile field, and he came in, and back then we autoclaved gloves. I don't know if you know what autoclave is. Well, it's under steam, heavy pressure steam, like a pressure cooker that your mm-hmm. mother may have canned fruit or something. It's the same thing, only it was a large cylinder. You put in all the instruments and your sterile gloves. They wrapped them, mm-hmm. of course, and after a period of time, they would rot, you know. And so I was holding the glove for the doctor to jam his hand down in. When he did, I had the ring halfway up his arm, and he had the glove down there. He got so mad that he threw my sterile field. Now, there's a kid on the table, operating mm-hmm. table. And I turned around to him. Now, he's a full commander, and I'm a hospital apprentice first class.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he stormed out of the room before he did. I said, wait, I said, that is the most stupidest thing that I have ever seen anyone do. I said, what if it had been a bursted appendix or something? And you put on this and you could have lost a man. Well, he went on out. I set up another field and I said, boy, I'm going to be court-martialed, sure. You know, you just didn't do that, you know.
Right.
And it was just an impulse with me. I'd been in combat, and I really didn't care, you know. I mean, I didn't care what they did with me. I just wanted to get out at that time. They took me out of combat and so forth. I was disillusioned. And he came back. I had a new Steeler Field. He apologized to me. Now, that takes a big man.
Yeah.
And I thought, sure, I'm going to be court-martialed and dishonorably discharged and everything else. So it worked out all right. But in fact, I think he wanted me to marry his daughter. and she weighed about 250 pounds. And he was looking for somebody to take him off her hands, I think. But at any rate, that's basically...
Okay. And when were you eventually let out of the service? When would that have been?
The last of 45.
Okay.
Right at the end of...
So you arrived at the River Rouge in... that probably would have been early summer of 45, and then you worked there for...
Well, Iwo Jima was in February, March, April. Probably in May, I was back in the States.
And then you were working continuously there until December when they let you out of the service, or...?
Yes, okay. Yes. Yeah.
And it sounds like the transition back from Iwo Jima to this facility, this medical, it was a tough transition. Did they do anything? Was anything done for people when they were coming back? Was there anything to help with the transition, or did you have any? Did your friends and family come out to where you were in Detroit to do anything? Or?
No, okay. No. There was no fanfare or nothing. We came back and. Course, when the big ships came back with all the troops on, there was, but you come back in and no one knows that you were even gone, practically, you know, no fanfare.
And then after you left the service, did you use the GI Bill? Did you use that for any education or...
No, actually, I went to night classes at junior college, and as I told you, I went in at the 10th grade, and so my wife and I both went to junior college night classes, and
this was down in St. Petersburg.
St. Petersburg.
Why did you decide to move down to St. Petersburg? Is there a specific reason for that?
It was too darn cold in Michigan.
I think that's why a lot of people come down to Florida.
Yeah. Well, after being in a warm climate for 3 years, and then you go back to where 5 months out of the year is freezing, practically, I just couldn't take it. And I rode a motorcycle from Michigan. I was going to race in Daytona. I wanted excitement in my life, you know. I couldn't wind down, and so I came down to race in Daytona. I'd sent my entrance fee and so forth. I never got to it because I got married, and my wife said, if you go there, you're not, I won't be here when you get back, so.
It's a good reason not to go
racing. I didn't go to the races, yeah. But I was dressed, ready to go. Yeah. But then I went into building, reverted back to what I had been brought up with my father being in construction and so forth.
And you've done work across most of the state of Florida, it sounds like.
Yes.
You worked on buildings in Miami, and then you've done stuff in Gainesville.
VA hospitals, schools, and so forth. And,
so it was larger. It wasn't home construction. It was primarily larger.
Well, I started out with home construction. We were building in 1947. The last of 47 in 1948, I married the boss's daughter.
Okay.
So, and
so that's,
he,
and so he is had, that how you met?
Yeah. He had a construction company. Oh, yeah. Well, she was the office, the secretary and bookkeeper for the company. And she looked like a little kid, you know. I didn't want to even date her or anything else because she was so young looking. And she had 2 years in junior college already, so she wasn't a young kid. I found that out later. But I didn't want responsibility, so I took a truck driver's job. And in doing this, I delivered the lumber, and there was a fella cutting molding that come down the rake of a roof and then turn back onto the fascia and soffit. And and he had a pile of cuttings maybe a foot high, you know, where he couldn't make the cut. And I told him, I said, if you're having some trouble, I said, I can make you a miter box that you can cut that with. And he said, well, mine is the best. It's a steel miter box. He said, I'm supposed to be able to do anything with it. I said, well, you give me a tube of six and a couple of one-bys and that are 6 inches high, and I build a box. And I said, let me have your framing square. And I took it and made the miter on it. And in cutting crown mold or something, you have to cut it where it fits flat against the side as well as the bottom.
Okay.
And so I made the cuts. And I cut it for two houses, working on two houses. And when I left, I just picked the miter box up and threw it behind my seat in the truck. And the boss came along, or my wife's father. And he said to the fella, he said, boy, you did a fine job. He said, you did it with the steel miter box? And he said, no. He said, I had to make a wooden one. And so he was looking all around, I guess. My father-in-law told me later that for the miter box, you know, and he had to admit that he didn't do it, that I did it. He said, the truck driver that delivered material did that. So he said, well, he apparently works for me. I'm going to run him down. So that's how I got into it.
Okay.
In 1958 and 59, we built Patrick Air Force Base. I was there for the first moonshot that went off, you know, the first shot that it was ever took off from Cape Canaveral. My wife and I were there for that, and we saw many other ones after that. But then I worked on schools, hospitals, military bases, the Bunker Hill Air Base in Indiana, and Fort Rucker, that's where they had a helicopter base there and so forth. And the VA hospital in Miami, that was the last big job I did. It was $21.5 million job.
And wow.
26 subcontractors. Well, this is not what you wanted to hear.
No, this is, I'm interested in hearing your experiences down here too.
Oh,
And what brought you to Gainesville, though? What eventually made you decide you wanted to live in the Gainesville area?
Get away from relation.
Okay.
No, I'm serious. My wife's parents and my mother would fuss about us spending more time with one than the other and so forth. And I had a brother that was always getting into problems, trouble, and so forth. And my mother would call and said, I want you to come over and give him a spanking. And I said, I don't go around giving spankings. You know, I'll take care of my own children. But, so at any rate, my wife and I decided we'd get away from both sides of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go and visit, not let the other one know when we come into town, just visit with one. And the next weekend, we'd come see the other one.
So both family were in St. Petersburg?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's disastrous. So at any rate, that's why we moved to Gainesville. We liked the area and so forth. And I actually had my own general contractor license in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
My father-in-law made me a little upset. He said it would take me 10 years to be a good carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
After he knew what I had done, you know,
yeah.
On the job. And he said 15 years to be a layout man. And within 7 weeks after he told me that, I had a license equal to his, an A license.
That was fairly early for Florida to start contracting license, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
But you had to take a test, and it was a humdinger. It was a real tough one. But it wasn't as bad as Boca Raton. That was a bad one to take. So I have had the good fortune of meeting a lot of great people.
Mm-hmm.
And you see in the trophy case there, I was the commander of the Gator Detachment of the Disabled American Veterans.
I did actually want to ask you about when you first started getting involved in veterans organizations.
That was it. When I got with the Disabled American Veterans, my nerves were shot pretty much. Because I went to Tulane University to take the entrance exam, and the studies were so many hours I had to work on it that my nerves just wouldn't let me. So that's when I got in the Disabled American Veterans. And my mother actually got me into the system. And
when would this have been? Just a ballpark range.
In 40,
so in the late 40s, it would have been.
Yeah. It would probably be in the 48. No, earlier than that, because I was in the hospital, the Veterans Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and that would have been in 1945 when I got out of the service.
Okay.
Because I was putting my fists through walls and everything else. I mean, I'd wake up nightmares still fighting the war and so forth, and my mother told them that she sent her son away, a nice fellow, and now he come back. He's tearing up walls and everything else. So it was in the latter, probably December or January of 45, 40, or early 46. But I actually got into the organizations of the DAV in probably 49, something like that, 49 or 50. And you see the second half, the first one is when I was the chapter commander here in Gainesville. In the hat next to it, you see the red rat?
Mm-hmm.
That's the order of the trench rat. That's from the First World War. You know, when they were in the trenches and mm-hmm. so forth, the wounded servicemen got together after the war and come out with the order of the trench rat. And then I got to be district commander, and I was going around the state so much on these big construction jobs that I had to give it up, you know, I just couldn't come back to this district mm-hmm. from Miami. I spent 8 years in Miami building VA hospitals, okay. educational building, the McKnight Eye Center, and the Fort Lauderdale, the big hospital there. Can't think of the name of it, but at any rate,
okay.
mostly hospital jobs and so forth.
And gradually, you've joined more veterans organizations since then. I just kind of wanted to ask, have you noticed any changes in veterans organizations since you've been in?
Oh yeah, it used to be that there was just an excuse to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really got into that because I've lived this long without smoking and drinking, so
yep.
I have it if anyone ever wanted it. But for me, there's two bottles of beer in the refrigerator that have been there since Christmas. Last Christmas, yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, I just don't have it, you know. I mean, I have it, but if anyone wants it, but for me to, I figure when I get a little age on me, maybe I can start drinking or something.
Okay.
Or smoking. But, no, I've lived this long without, you know, I've kept fairly good shape. I'll be 83 years old in January, so.
Well, I've also noticed, talking with some people in veterans organizations, some of them have said that earlier organizations, there might have been a little bit more politics with regards to different service branches. If the VFW has a majority of Army people, maybe a Navy person doesn't feel as welcome, or if it has... I know people have said that that's changed a little bit.
I've never noticed that.
Okay.
I've never noticed that. Politics, I mean, there's always been people that would make remarks about another service, you know,
mm-hmm.
but in jest.
Okay.
Only in jest, not mm-hmm. the... Well, if the people drank a lot,
mm-hmm.
then you would get it. Then that may be where you're talking to people.
Okay.
But as a whole, I haven't noticed. And the Marine Corps League that I'm in, you see, they didn't let corpsmen in until about a year and a half ago. And they wanted me to join as a auxiliary. I helped them with Toys for Tots, and I said, no, I'm not going to join if you don't consider me a Marine. I'm not going to join. I said, the 4th Marine Division accepts me as a Marine, and you mean the Marine Corps League won't? And so they finally passed it. And you know, the first... commandant of the Marine Corps League was an Army, a Navy doctor.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but yet in their bylaws, they had that you had to be a Marine. So, but no, I don't, I haven't.
Is there any problems with different places where people have been in service, or different combat that people have been, later wars, or maybe members of the Korean War as opposed to Vietnam veterans joining some organizations. Has that created any kind of conflict at all, or has it been?
No, and people who have been in combat, real combat,
mm-hmm.
do not look down on anyone, because behind every man in combat, there was a man behind getting supplies to him, and a mm-hmm. man behind him making the supplies. And as I say, people that have been in combat do not look down, mm-hmm. even on people who didn't go in the service, because they feel that they were lucky, you know, that they, of course, they, if you went out of the country to keep from going, that's one thing, but if you were working, but as a whole, people who have been in war don't look down on anyone else.
Okay.
No other branch or anything. They might make comments.
Well, I was just wondering. Another thing is that I've heard is sometimes different organizations, the leadership, there might be a different part of the leadership, or I don't know really. I guess the last thing I wanted to ask, sort of with regards to veterans organizations, is their role in helping other veterans. Have you seen that change at all over your experience, or has it been an opportunity, or have some of the organizations you've been more of a therapeutic opportunity for people to discuss with other people who've experienced that, or is that something that hasn't happened as much, or has that changed over?
Well, ones that have been in deep combat do not talk a lot about mm-hmm. what goes on, and in fact, there are some people that can discuss the war in detail, very gory detail. I can't, but that doesn't make them different or anything. It's just different people's makeup, but as I say, anyone who's been in combat does not look down on anyone. They just feel thankful that they're here to talk about it. And anybody that asks me how I am, my favorite saying is, any day I wake up at my age, it's a great day. And it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, compared to the alternative.
Well, I know the other thing is, I know that we talked a little bit about some of the things that you've been doing outside groups with the Florida, different Florida youth groups.
Mm-hmm.
Could you briefly explain some of the stuff you're doing and why you decided to get involved in some of that?
Well, it's the same with talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
The young people need to know some of the history that has been created to make a safer place for them to live. And it's like the young people that are serving in Iraq right now are doing the same thing we did in the Second World War. In my mind, it's keeping the enemy from our shores.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm a firm believer, if we weren't keeping them over there fighting, they would be here blowing themselves up on school buses and in schools, and no one would be safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a firm believer in it. Maybe I'm wrong, but history has, if you don't pay attention to history, you're destined to do it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid this is what's going to happen. So.
Okay. Well, did you have anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we conclude? I think we've covered a lot.
I think we covered a great deal.
Okay. Well, it's been very nice speaking with you.
Well, likewise. Okay. I think the young people in schools need to learn something of the wars and so forth that have made it where they can say what they want, they can do what they want, and being under a free system. Because if they were in any other country, they would be hard-pressed to have the freedoms that we have today. Mm-hmm. Because of the sacrifices that each and every one gave all that they could when they were trying to keep this country free.
Okay.